Chapter 116. Striving in a damnable hotel. Here was a prospect which held hope in it. Gwendolyn thought of hours when she would be alone, since Grandcourt would not want to take her in the said boat, and in her exultation at this unlooked-for relief, as he had wild, contradictory fancies of what she might do with her freedom, that running away which as he had already innumerable times seen to be a worse evil than any actual endurance, now finding new arguments as an escape from her worse self. Also, visionary relief on a par with the fancy of a prisoner, that the night wind may blow down the wall of his prison, and save him from desperate devices, insinuated itself as a better alternative, lawful to wish for. The fresh current of expectation revived her energies, and enabled her to take all things with an air of cheerfulness and alacrity that made a change marked enough to be noticed by her husband. She watched through the evening lights to the sinking of the moon with less of odd loneliness than was habitual to her, nay, with a vague impression that in this mighty frame of things there might be some preparation of rescue for her. Why not? Since the weather had just been on her side. This possibility of hoping, after her long fluctuation amid fears, was like a first return of hunger to the long-languishing patient. She was waked the next morning by the casting of the anchor in the port of Genoa, waked from a strangely mixed dream in which she felt herself escaping over the Mont Cenis, and wondering to find it warmer even in the moonlight on the snow, till suddenly she met Deronda, who told her to go back. In an hour or so from that dream she actually met Deronda. But it was on the palatial staircase of the Italia, where she was feeling warm in her light woolen dress and straw hat, and her husband, and was by her side. There was a start of surprise in Deronda, before he could raise his hat and pass on. The moment did not seem to favor any closer greeting, and the circumstances under which they had last parted made him doubtful whether Grandcourt would be civilly inclined to him. The doubt might certainly have been changed into a disagreeable certainty, for Grandcourt, on this unaccountable appearance of Deronda at Genoa of all places, immediately tried to conceive how there could have been an arrangement between him and Gwendolyn. It is true that before they were well in their rooms, he had seen how difficult it was to shape such an arrangement with any probability, being too cool-headed to find it at once easily credible that Gwendolyn had, not only while in London, hastened to inform Deronda of the yachting project, but had posted a letter to him from Marseille or Barcelona, advising him to travel to Genoa in time for the chance of meeting her there, or of receiving a letter from her telling of some other destination, all which must have implied a miraculous foreknowledge in her, and in Deronda a bird-like facility in flying about and perching idly. Still he was there, and though Grandcourt would not make a fool of himself by fabrications that others might call preposterous, he was not, for all that, disposed to admit fully that Deronda's presence was, so far as Gwendolyn was concerned, a mere accident. It was a disgusting fact, that was enough, and no doubt she was well pleased. A man out of temper does not wait for proofs before feeling toward all things animate and inanimate, as if they were in a conspiracy against him, but at once threshes his horse, or kicks his dog in consequence. Grandcourt felt toward Gwendolyn and Deronda, as if he knew them to be in a conspiracy against him, and here was an event in league with them. What he took for clearly certain, and so far he divined the truth, was that Gwendolyn was now counting on an interview with Deronda, whenever her husband's back was turned. As he sat taking his coffee at a convenient angle for observing her, he discerned something which he felt sure was the effect of a secret delight, some fresh ease in moving and speaking, some peculiar meaning in her eyes, whatever she looked on. Certainly her troubles had not marred her beauty. Mrs. Grandcourt was handsomer than Gwendolyn Harleth. Her grace and expression were informed by a greater variety of inward experience, giving new play to her features, new attitudes in movement and repose, Her whole person and air at the nameless something which often makes a woman more interesting after marriage than before, less confident that all things are according to her opinion, and yet with less of deer-like shyness more fully a human being. This morning the benefits of the voyage seemed to be suddenly revealing themselves in a new elasticity of mien. As she rose from the table, and put her two heavily jeweled hands on each side of her neck, according to her wont, as he had no art, to conceal that sort of joyous expectation which makes the present more bearable than usual, just as when a man means to go out he finds it easier to be amiable to the family for a quarter of an hour beforehand. It is not impossible that a terrier whose pleasure was concerned would perceive those amiable signs, and know their meaning, know why his master stood in a peculiar way, talked with alacrity, and even had a peculiar gleam in his eye, so that on the least movement toward the door, the terrier would scuttle to be in time. And, in dog fashion, Grandcourt discerned the signs of Gwendolyn's expectation, interpreting them with the narrow correctness which leaves a world of unknown feeling behind. "Just ring, please, and tell Gibbs to order some dinner for us at 3, said Grandcourt, as he too rose, took out a cigar, and then stretched his hand toward the hat that lay near. "I'm going to send Angus to find a little sailing boat for us to go out in. One that I can manage, with you at the tiller. It's uncommonly pleasant these fine evenings, the least boring of anything we can do." Gwendolyn turned cold. There was not only the cruel disappointment, there was the immediate conviction that her husband had determined to take her, because he would not leave her out of his sight, and probably this dual solitude in a boat was the more attractive to him, because it would be wearisome to her. They were not on the plank island. She felt it the more possible to begin a contest. But the gleaming content had died out of her. There was a change in her like that of a glacier after sunset. "I would rather not go in the boat," she said. "Tea, take someone else with you." "Very well. If you don't go, I shall not go," said Grandcourt. "We shall stay suffocating here, that's all." "I can't bear to go in a boat," said Gwendolyn, angrily. "That is a sudden change," said Grandcourt, with a slight sneer. But, since you decline, we shall stay indoors." He laid down his hat again, lit a cigar, and walked up and down the room, pausing now and then, to look out of the windows. Gwendolyn's temper told her to persist. She knew very well now that Grandcourt would not go without her. But if he must tyrannize over her, he should not do it precisely in the way he would choose. She would oblige him to stay in the hotel. Without speaking again, she passed into the adjoining bedroom, and threw herself into a chair with her anger, seeing no purpose or issue, only feeling that the wave of evil had rushed back upon her, and dragged her away from her momentary breathing place. Presently Grandcourt came in with his hat on, but threw it off and sat down sideways on a chair nearly in front of her, saying, in his superficial drawl, "Have you come round yet, or do you find it agreeable to be out of temper? You make things uncommonly pleasant for me." "Why do you want to make them unpleasant for me?" said Gwendolyn, getting helpless again, and feeling the hot tears rise. "Now, will you be good enough to say what it is you have to complain of?" said Grandcourt, looking into her eyes, and using his most inward voice. "Is it that I stay indoors when you stay?" She could give no answer. The sort of truth that made any excuse for her anger could not be uttered. In the conflict of despair and humiliation she began to sob, and the tears rolled down her cheeks, a form of agitation which as he had never shown before in her husband's presence. "I hope this is useful," said Grandcourt, after a moment or two. "All I can say is, it's most confoundedly unpleasant. What the devil women can see in this kind of thing, I don't know. You see something to be got by it, of course. All I can see is, that we shall be shut up here, when we might have been having a pleasant sail." "Let us go, then," said Gwendolyn, impetuously. "Perhaps we shall be drowned." She began to sob again. This extraordinary behavior, which had evidently some relation to the Ronda, gave more definiteness to Grandcourt's conclusions. He drew his chair quite close in front of her, and said, in a low tone, just be quiet and listen, will you? There seemed to be a magical effect in this close vicinity. Gwendolyn shrank and ceased to sob. She kept her eyelids down, and clasped her hands tightly. Let us understand each other, said Grandcourt, in the same tone. I know very well what this nonsense means. But if you suppose I am going to let you make a fool of me, just dismiss that notion from your mind. What are you looking forward to, if you can't behave properly as my wife? There is disgrace for you, if you like to have it, but I don't know anything else, and as to the Ronda, it's quite clear that he hangs back from you. It's all false, said Gwendolyn, bitterly. You don't in the least imagine what is in my mind. I have seen enough of the disgrace that comes in that way, and you had better leave me at liberty to speak with anyone I like. It will be better for you. You will allow me to judge of that, said Grandcourt, rising and moving to a little distance toward the window, but standing there playing with his whiskers as if he were awaiting something. Gwendolyn's words had so clear and tremendous a meaning for herself that she thought they must have expressed it to Grandcourt, and had no sooner uttered them than she dreaded their effect. But his soul was garrisoned against presentiments and fears. He had the courage and confidence that belonged to domination, and he was at that moment feeling perfectly satisfied that he held his wife with bit and bridle. By the time they had been married a year, she would cease to be restive. He continued standing with his air of indifference, till she felt her habitual stifling consciousness of having an immovable obstruction in her life, like the nightmare of beholding a single form that serves to arrest all passage, though the wide country lies open. What decision have you come to? He said, presently looking at her. What orders shall I give? Oh, let us go, said Gwendolyn. The walls had begun to be an imprisonment, and while there was breath in this man he would have the mastery over her. His words had the power of thumbscrews, and the cold touch of the rock. To resist was to act like a stupid animal unable to measure results. So the boat was ordered. She even went down to the quay again with him to see it before midday. Grandcourt had recovered perfect quietude of temper, and had a scornful satisfaction in the attention given by the nautical groups to the Millard, owner of the handsome yacht which had just put in for repairs, and who being an Englishman was naturally so at home on the sea that he could manage a sail with the same ease that he could manage a horse. The sort of exultation he had discerned in Gwendolyn this morning she now thought that she discerned in him. And it was true that he had set his mind on this boating, and carried out his purpose as something that people might not expect him to do, with the gratified impulse of a strong will which had nothing better to exert itself upon. He had remarkable physical courage, and was proud of it, or rather he had a great contempt for the coarser, bulkier men who generally had less. Moreover, he was ruling that Gwendolyn should go with him. And when they came down again at 5 o'clock, equipped for their boating, the scene was as good as a theatrical representation for all beholders. This handsome, fair-skinned English couple, manifesting the usual eccentricity of their nation, both of them proud, pale, and calm, without a smile on their faces, moving like creatures who were fulfilling a supernatural destiny. It was a thing to go out and see, a thing to paint. The husband's chest, back, and arms showed very well in his close-fitting dress, and the wife was declared to be a statue. Some suggestions were proffered concerning a possible change in the breeze, and the necessary care in putting about, but Grandcourt's manner made the speakers understand that they were too officious, and that he knew better than they. Gwendolyn, keeping her impassible air, as they moved away from the strand, felt her imagination obstinately at work. She was not afraid of any outward dangers, she was afraid of her own wishes which were taking shapes possible and impossible, like a cloud of demon faces. She was afraid of her own hatred, which under the cold iron touch that had compelled her today, had gathered a fierce intensity. As she sat guiding the tiller under her husband's eyes, doing just what he told her, the strife within her seemed like her own effort to escape from herself. She clung to the thought of Deronda. She persuaded herself that he would not go away. While she was there, he knew that she needed help. The sense that he was there would save her from acting out the evil within. And yet quick, quick, came images, plans of evil, that would come again, and seize her in the night, like furies preparing the deed, that they would straightway avenge. They were taken out of the port, and carried eastward by a gentle breeze. Some clouds tempered the sunlight, and the hour was always deepening toward the supreme beauty of evening. Sails larger and smaller changed their aspect like sensitive things, and made a cheerful companionship, alternately near and far. The grand city shone more vaguely, the mountains looked out above it, and there was stillness as in an island sanctuary. Yet suddenly Gwendolyn let her hands fall, and said in a scarcely audible tone, "God help me!" "What is the matter?" said Grandcourt, not distinguishing the words. "Oh, nothing," said Gwendolyn, rousing herself from her momentary forgetfulness and resuming the ropes. "Don't you find this pleasant?" said Grandcourt. "Very." "You admit now we couldn't have done anything better?" "No, I see nothing better. I think we shall go on always, like the Flying Dutchman," said Gwendolyn wildly. Grandcourt gave her one of his narrow examining glances, and then said, "If you like, we can go to Spezia in the morning, and let them take us up there." "No, I shall like nothing better than this." "Very well. We'll do the same tomorrow. But we must be turning in soon. I shall put about." Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.